In this part of Focus this morning, we'll be exploring the history of the spiritual movement called Falun Gong. It was founded in China in 1992, combining elements of Buddhism and Taoism with some other less conventional ideas about the universe and human beings and where they come from. The sect has been officially banned by the government in China, and its members have been arrested and persecuted, and some of them have actually died in the government hands. This morning, we'll be talking about what Falun Gong is and why it is that the Chinese government seems to fear it so much. And our guest for the program is Maria Xia Zheng. She's professor of political science at University of Nevada at Reno. She was born in Hong Kong of refugee parents from China. She left there after high school, came to the United States, where she went to university. She got her PhD in political science from University of California, Berkeley, and has authored a book that's just recently come out that's titled Falun Gong, The End of Days, and it's published by the Yale University Press. And is, I believe, the first real comprehensive look at Falun Gong and its founder, some of the key beliefs, the response that the Chinese government has had to Falun Gong, and placing that in some kind of historical context as far as the history of China is concerned. Questions, of course, are welcome. The only thing we ask is people are brief, just so we can keep our program moving and get in as many people as possible. But, of course, anyone can call. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us, around Illinois, Indiana. Actually, if you are listening on the Internet, as long as you're in the United States, you can use the toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. So 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana listeners. And toll-free, 800-222-9455. Professor Zheng, hello.
Good morning, David.
Well, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Well, I'm delighted to be invited on your show.
I suppose the place to start, or a good place to start, would be where you begin your story, and that is to talk about the demonstration that occurred in the spring of 1999 in Beijing. And this event brought, I think, Falun Gong to the attention of the world. I think outside of China, before that, not very many people had heard about it. So it was important in that sense. And also it was significant because it, after that, the Chinese government changed its attitude toward Falun Gong. Tell us what happened on that day, April 25th, 1999.
Right. It was a spring day in Beijing. And at dawn, seemingly out of nowhere, 10,000 to 16,000 followers of Falun Gong convened in the heart of Beijing near Tiananmen Square. Specifically, they surrounded Zhongnanhai. Zhongnanhai is the Communist Party headquarters that is next to the Forbidden City. And these were the thousands of followers of this particular religion, were, you know, they ranged in age from little kids to elderly people in their 70s and 80s. They looked middle class mostly. They were well behaved, and you know, they sat on the ground, and almost all of them had a little blue book in their hands, and that is one of the books of Li Hongzi, published by the Falun Gong Press. And they stay there all day. They were well behaved, as I said. They were peaceful. They did not carry any political signs or made any political statements. And it was a powerful and silent protest against what they regarded as the government's unjust treatment of that group. And specifically, they were protesting the arrest of about 11 of them the previous day in Tianjin. Tianjin was some distance away from Beijing, not too far away.
Mm. Well, we can go into that a little bit greater depth, but just to ask a follow-up question to give you the opportunity to talk about why the government reacted the way that it did. Apparently the here's a government that that takes great care to try to monitor what's going on in the country and what people are doing. And apparently for the government, it was a great shock to have this large group of people to materialize at that point, to have had this organized effort going on, and the government had no inkling at all that this was going to happen until, apparently, the people showed up.
Precisely. That was one of the reasons why the Communist Party leaders went into shock that day. And, I mean, what happened on April the 25th, 1999, was really the largest demonstration since the pro-democracy demonstrations and movement of 1989 that was so brutally suppressed on June 4th, 1989. So that was shocking to the authorities, that they had no inkling this was being organized. Please excuse my bird for his raucous squawking. I hope that doesn't disturb you.
That's okay. No, he's entitled to squawk.
Okay. Course, the other thing that sent the government into shock was that they soon realized that among the followers of Falun Gong were Communist Party members and members of the People's Liberation Army, the Chinese military.
Around this time, there started to be some effort by the government, or at least one suspects by the government, or people connected to the government, to cast a not a very favorable light on Falun Gong, and so that it was in part what the followers, the adherents, were wanting to demonstrate against. If you go back a little bit, though, Falun Gong at this point had been in existence for maybe about 5 years or so. What had, and the government certainly was aware of Falun Gong, they knew that it existed. What had previously, though, been the attitude of the government toward Falun Gong?
Well, previously, the government's attitude was really very favorable. Falun Gong, as you said, was founded in 1992, and it was one of many Qigong groups. Qigong is literally translated as energy cultivation. Qi is what ancient Chinese believe as being this flow of energy in the universe and inside human bodies. And Qigong would be really a set of breathing and mild exercises that the Chinese, dating back to thousands of years, believe that if you do that will not only promote your health and then it's going to, you know, facilitate the flow of this energy throughout your body, but that they, you know, at least the ancient Chinese believed that it could also prolong life and maybe perhaps even grant one immortality. But anyway, Falun Gong was one of many Qigong groups that mushroomed throughout China beginning in the late 1970s when the Chinese Communist Party government relaxed its control over voluntary groups in society. And at first, the leadership's attitude towards these Qigong groups was extremely positive because they thought that, well, you know, this is going to be an outlet for the people, this is going to promote health, that's going to reduce, you know, health costs for the state. And so they welcomed these groups until, of course, in Falun Gong's case in particular, that it proved to be so popular. And once it became so popular, then the government started worrying about this group and started being fearful about that. And through its official and unofficial, specifically unofficial spokesman, the government began then to, you know, hinted and at, well, Falun Gong is a cult. And of course, the word cult, translated into Chinese, in Chinese history, has an arguably even worse connotation than, say, in Western society. And this really goes back to, you know, the relationship between the Chinese state in dynastic periods and religions that the state identify as being not orthodox, as being heterodox, and therefore always suspect.
And this, so here we're getting to the events getting close to that demonstration in 99, where for a period before that, say beginning perhaps about the year before, this was at the point where then the government or people who were acting in the interest of the government started to do things to cast Falun Gong in bad light, raise questions about it. And in particular, there was an article that was published in a magazine by a Chinese scientist. He was a physicist and the idea, I think, of the article was to say that Qigong was maybe not such a good thing, and he very particularly singled out Falun Gong, and it was this that was the driving force behind the demonstration that had happened in Tianjin that you talked about a little bit earlier, mm-hmm. A long way away from the capital. But then it was sort of like the proverbial snowball rolling down the hill. We had the small incident in Tianjin, and then because of the way that those people were treated, then in the larger sense, the movement decided, well, we have to make a response. We want to make a statement to the government of China, a peaceful statement, but a statement nonetheless. And so that's how it is that this demonstration, the April 99 demonstration, was organized, where these many, many Qigong adherents turned up outside of Zhongnanhai, where the Chinese leadership lives in the Forbidden City.
You're perfectly right. You're remarkably well informed. I mean, isn't too much that I can add to that, except that, I mean, you're perfectly right. What the Tianjin incident that happened the day immediately before the massive demonstration in Beijing was instigated by an article written by a Chinese physicist in a obscure youth magazine, in which, as you had just said, he tried to steer young people away from Qigong groups and said that, you know, I'm really not so sure whether these really are good groups to belong to, and specifically Falun Gong. He cast great doubts on Falun Gong's claim that doing the exercises would actually promote health, and he then used the C word, you know, to identify as a cult. Hmm. And even before that, there were signs that things weren't going well with the government in terms of his attitude towards Falun Gong, in that all groups in China, you know, voluntary groups, private groups in society, including religious groups, must meet with the state's approval in order for them to exist. And specifically, they must register with the government. And so the act of registering with the government, in essence, is to obtain the government's approval. Now, Falun Gong in 1992, when it was founded, did get state approval, but then by about 1997, the state withdrew its approval, and so it was no longer an approved, registered group. In other words, it became a kind of an informal group, and being an informal private group in society without a government's approval, then, you know, one runs the danger of the state coming down on you at any time. Hmm. And so this, in other words, the writing was on the wall. And as a matter of fact, Falun Gong's founder, a gentleman by the name, the last name of Li, and his Chinese name is Li Hongzi, he, and of course his followers call him Master Li. By this time, you know, a year really before the massive demonstration, Li had really already figured out that things are not looking good. And he himself emigrated with his family to the United States.
Let me introduce again our guest for this part of Focus 580, Maria Xiaojiang. She's professor of political science at the University of Nevada at Reno and has authored a book entitled Falun Gong, The End of Days. It's published by the Yale University Press and has come out recently. If you're interested in reading on the subject, you could certainly look for the book. Questions are also welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. One of the things that you do that I think it helps perhaps people in the West understand a little bit better the reaction of the Chinese government is to put Falun Gong in a kind of historical context. And one might ask the question, why would the government consider it to be a threat? And perhaps, as you say, just the ability, the demonstrated ability to organize a kind of demonstration like the one in April of 99, the fact that it would seem that there are a great many people who are associated with Qigong or with Falun Gong, or practitioners or followers, and they do count followers in the tens of millions. So that in and of itself might be enough reason for the government to react the way it did. But there's another layer here that one would only appreciate if you were familiar with Chinese history, and that is the fact that other similar groups in China's past have been responsible for significant political change. And this was something that the Chinese leadership would know full well and that might give them reason to be worried about a group like Falun Gong.
You're perfectly right. I mean, that's really the more profound underlying reason why the Chinese government reacted so ferociously against this group, that in a manner, with a ferocity that I dare say really baffles many in outside China. And this really goes back to this long Chinese history of dynastic change and religious millenarian movements. Now, early on, I had alluded to the fact that that in contemporary China and China today, that private groups, including religious groups, must have the state's permission in order really to operate openly and legitimately. And what is fascinating is that this kind of relationship between private groups and the state is simply a continuation of a millennial tradition in China, in dynastic China. It was exactly the same situation. And this really goes back to how in imperial China, that the Chinese emperor was an extremely powerful monarch, much more so than in, say, medieval Europe, in that the Chinese emperor was both head of state and also head of the state church, which in imperial China was Confucianism. So Confucianism was both an ideology, a philosophy, as well as a religion. And it was Confucianism that really gave legitimacy to the Chinese emperor by appealing to this notion that this abstract force called heaven had specifically mandated, given its approval to this individual and his offsprings, to be emperor. And thus the Chinese emperor, had called himself the Son of Heaven. And so since Confucianism was so important, really, for political power, the Chinese emperors had then always regarded other religions with always a degree of suspicion, right? In that if those religions were ever to become powerful enough as to challenge Confucianism, then that would also challenge the basis of legitimacy of the emperor's rule. And so, and of course, in traditional China, there's been two major heterodox religions, that is, non-Confucian religions, and as I'm sure many of your listeners know very well, those two would be Taoism and Buddhism. And so not surprisingly then, religious groups in society that were Taoist and or Buddhist in nature then would be closely watched by the state. And so what is ironic is that this kind of suspicion by the Chinese emperors and today, the Communist Party, the suspicion about these groups, in a way, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, right? In that, well, the state, is suspicious about these groups and, say, will not allow it permission really to operate openly, and then this forces these groups to go underground to operate as religious secret societies, and then going underground and being secretive in nature then exacerbates the government's suspicion about these groups, And so then that in turn forces these groups, these religious groups, although in the beginning they were purely religious and apolitical in nature, the very fact that they're now being oppressed and suppressed turned them political. And so then that, you know, simply confirms in the government's mind, you know, these are groups that are not loyal to me, that particularly if they are organized and particularly if they are very popular, that means that if they have this organizational network in place, any time if the leader of this group so chooses to, he then might mobilize his following to instigate a rebellion against me. And of course, in Chinese history, at times of dynastic decay, that's exactly what happened time and time again, in that kind of a, you know, near totalitarian political system such as Imperial China, that you know, groups that were alienated from the dynasty, from the emperor, for one reason or another, then they organize themselves into secret societies. Many of them take on this religious flavor and provide, you know, express their grievances, you know, in part in this religious nature. And throughout Chinese history, indeed, these religious millenarian, you know, apocalyptic groups, indeed, many of them have been instrumental in overthrowing dynasties, beginning with the very first case before Christ, back in 209 BC.
I'm really fascinated by the idea of the fact that the emperors claim to rule by divine right, and they claim to, as you say, they claim to have the mandate of heaven, although woe be any ruler if something really bad happened, if there was famine, there was floods, there was unrest, there was invasion, anything that made it look like you had lost the mandate of heaven, then you were in big trouble. Contemporary China is a secular state, but I guess I'm interested in the idea about whether this idea of the mandate of heaven still sort of is sort of there yet, and that so that the contemporary government would really be concerned about anybody coming along making the argument that somehow the current rulers, the current government, had lost the right, wherever that right comes from, had lost the right to rule.
Yeah, I mean, you've made a very good point here. For people who are really knowledgeable about contemporary China in the sense of knowing not just the People's Republic of China, you know, the Chinese Communist Party history, but also really stretching back to the millennial history of China, one is really more struck by how the People's Republic today really resembles dynastic China more than one would think on the surface. And there are others, including myself, who have made a case for the official ideology of the Chinese Communist Party, that of Marxism-Leninism, hyphen Mao, hyphen Deng Xiaoping thought, and that really the nature of that, of the Communist Party's ideology, in terms of is the party's insistence that this is really the only correct way to think and the only correct way of viewing the world, and in its intolerance and hostility toward dissenting ideas, that really ideology in China takes on more of a flavor of religion rather than, you know, ideology, say, here in the United States, right? And so in that sense, one can see the parallel. And what is remarkable, I mean, in a way, is to think that China would have changed drastically in 1949 because a political party called the Communist Party came into power and thus transformed everything. When, if you look back to Chinese history, I mean, there's at least 4,000 years of Chinese history where China seems to have stayed very much the same despite, you know, peasant rebellions and changes of dynasties. It's a kind of unchanging cyclical nature about China. I mean, what the saying goes, you know, the more things change, the more things remain the same, apply very much to China. To think that this entity called China, right, that have stayed remarkably the same, right, in terms of its culture, in terms of its basic political institutions, in terms of this basic, you know, orientation and worldview, to think that that entity that had persisted for over 4,000 years, relatively unchanged, would be drastically transformed in 1949 really stretches credibility.
Well, I have a caller here to bring into our conversation.
Terrific.
We'll do that. Someone here in Champaign, line number one. Hello.
Yes, I was curious about your title. That hasn't yet been explained, and you've used the word millenarian movements, and I was hoping that you would explain that more, because I think more of those as being Christian movements, or possibly one might apply it to some Muslim movements, so I'd like you to explain that more. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have some other questions, but let's start with that.
Excellent question. I was hoping somebody would ask that. First of all, about millenarian, the word millenarian as being applied to these Chinese religious movements throughout history. Millenarian, obviously, you're perfectly right that this really stems from Christianity, but that doesn't mean one cannot borrow the word. All right, so millenarian in the Chinese case referred to these Buddhist, Taoist religious societies in Chinese history that became very unhappy with life as it was, with the way society was. And not accidentally, these movements tend to rise up, as I said before, in times of dynastic decay, when the rulers or government officials become corrupt, right, and they begin neglecting really their responsibilities. And in China's case in particular, government would begin to neglect the maintenance of the all-important hydraulic system in China, on which Chinese agriculture depends so desperately. And by hydraulic system, I'm referring to dams, I'm referring to irrigation channels, to construction of effective dikes along rivers that would prevent the rivers from flooding rice fields. And so, and you know, as people's lives become increasingly impossible to bear, then many peasants would become bandits, because they can really no longer make a living at home. And so thus added to the litany of troubles in society would be the problem of these wandering hordes of people. And so, you know, not you know, quite understandably, there would be groups that would arise led by articulate leaders who would then very effectively express public grievances against the reigning rulers. And so in the Chinese tradition, because Buddhism and Taoism provide these groups with this kind of framework, right? So then very often the alienated peoples would then join these religious groups. And so what they believed in, well, and particularly in Buddhism's case, right, what they believed in was that all these signs of troubles are signs of the impending end times, right? That heaven, the gods in heaven are unhappy with the political rulers, because the rulers are now corrupt and immoral, and that the end of days are imminent, and they anticipate that the government would collapse, that society would go into chaos, And of course, their group will then see to it that this is going to happen. Right? And after which, then there would be major chaos and destruction. But the good people then will survive, and then will, you know, rebuild society. And so, you know, these are sort of, you know, secular, in a way, secular versions of the Christian millenarianism. Now, in Falun Gong's case, the reason why I subtitled the book "The End of Days," and this is something that that Falun Gong, the organization itself, it now has a headquarters in New York. The Falun Gong itself is very, very loath to convey to the public, right? And I think it has done a pretty good job of really keeping a low profile about its apocalyptic flavor. But let me just refer to, because, you know, for the research of my book, I really went through all of Falun Gong's published writings, all attributable to Li Hongzhi, the founder himself. Again and again, throughout his books, right, he would, you know, refer to that that we are in the Dharma ending period, that he expects that there would be an apocalypse. He would use, you know, terms like the great havoc is coming and the end times are coming. And end times in Chinese would be the expression mo jie, right? Apocalypse in Chinese would be jie nan. And you know, throughout his books, he would say that, you know, human society, not just in China, but human society in general, is really in a state of terrible moral decay, right? And that it is because of human depravity and immorality that has angered the gods, right? And that thus then the gods then will wreak havoc and destruction on humanity.
Hmm.
And thus, that's why Li Hongzhi said, that's why I'm here, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because in these end times that Li Hongzhi insisted that governments everywhere, not just in China, governments and other religions are really impotent in the face of this moral decay. And Li Hongzhi insisted that his Falun Gong, right, he and his Falun Gong really are the only salvific sort of outlet. And that if you follow him, if you believe him, if you practice the spiritual cultivation, you know, mainly through the five sects of exercises that Falun Gong teaches, that, and if you try to be a good person, and follow the three virtues that he teaches, and the three virtues would be Zheng San Ren, which translated into English, Zheng means truthfulness, that is to always speak the truth, and then Shan can be translated as being as virtue of benevolence, goodness, right? And the third virtue, Ren really means forbearance, right? Forbearance, fortitude, that the individual tolerates and forbear any hardship that befalls you.
Right.
And so Li Hongzhi instructs his disciples that if you do this, if you follow these three virtues, be a good person, do the spiritual cultivation exercises, the Qigong exercises, then he said that, well, then when the end times come, you will be the good people who will survive, who will be saved, but all the bad people will all be eliminated, will all be destroyed.
Sounds like a biblical prophet.
there are many of them, isn't there?
Right. Is there any nationalistic approach at all? It's basically supposedly apolitical, that if you be good, then you're going to be able to bypass all the evil of those mm-hmm. other people that are involved with governments and politics.
Yeah. Well, you know, Falun Gong's beliefs, Li Hongzhi's teachings, I would say, you know, some 90 to 95% are completely apolitical. Now, one can see a political bent to that, to them, in this sense, right? That, well, you know, society, including in China, is depraved. And in China, he attributed the moral decay primarily to the reforms that began under Deng Xiaoping in China, began in 1979, that introduced westernization, industrialization, you know, increased the gap between the rich and the poor, and made some segments of society, you know, very unhappy. And so in that sense, then you can see an indirect criticism of the Chinese Communist Party there. Right? Now, of course, then once the Chinese government cracked down on his group, then, of course, as I said before, it becomes a self-fulfilling kind of situation. Then Falun Gong and his spokespeople, including Li Hongzhi himself, their statements then began to take on an increasingly political flavor to it.
I'm wondering, China is always used to be called, quote, the Middle Kingdom. It's kind of a trite saying, but now it's becoming much more of a world political actor, not to say that in the times of Mao it wasn't important and considered a threat on this side of the world, but... You were saying that you didn't think that the world changed overnight, and when Mao Zedong took over. How do you think some of the more ancient beliefs that China or the Chinese have about themselves will affect their interactions in international politics and economics?
I'm not sure I understand your question. I suppose the way I would understand it is in the context of this notion of China being the Middle Kingdom.
Well, more...
Do you want to rephrase your question?
Well, of seeing themselves as, you know, sort of the center of the world, and you were talking about kind of Confucian ideas that didn't necessarily go away, that you had a state Confucian ideology and then you had a state communist ideology, but you didn't think that the way these functioned were necessarily completely different.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, you brought up this China in the past as being the Middle Kingdom, Zhongguo, right? Literally Middle Kingdom. And China still really refers to itself as Zhongguo. And of course, you know, the Middle Kingdom name really refers to something more than a name, which is that it goes back to Imperial China, Dynastic China's worldview and its view about how China fits in with the rest of the world. And you know, throughout the 4,000 years of China's existence, China was indisputably, I mean, this was just reality. China was indisputably the hegemonic power in Asia, and Asia was China's known world. And so, you know, compared to China, the surrounding peoples, such as today what we call Koreans, the Japanese, the Mongolians to the north, today's Vietnamese, you know, and the other Southeast Asian peoples, they were simply, quote-unquote, inferior to China, inferior in the sense that China was more developed in its culture, in its whatever one understands the word civilization to mean. And so the Chinese had always had this view of themselves as being a kind of a superior people and a superior civilization. And of course, this attitude about itself was then reinforced by the way the surrounding peoples treated China, which was that they would look upon China as being kind of like a big brother. And indeed, the Japanese, the Koreans, and the Vietnamese, in the beginning, actually imported the Chinese written characters, written script, as their written script until in each case, they then developed really their own written script. So that, you know, serves as an indicator, perhaps, of China's dominance, right, in this known world. And of course, all of that then China came to a very rude awakening about its Middle Kingdom mentality, beginning, of course, in the mid-19th century when Western traders came on the scene, and specifically the British. And all of that then eventually precipitated a series of wars that began with the Opium War that really shattered China's self-image. But some of that self-image arguably has remained, right? And so, I mean, in terms of the Beijing's behaviors today, many sinologists, and I think I would include myself as among them, that what China aspires to and sees itself increasingly as being, you know, that China should rightfully, they believe, return to is traditional hegemonic position in Asia and the Pacific, all right? And as China's reforms, economic reforms, have been extremely fruitful, and, China has averaged economic growth rate since 1979 of 9 to 10% a year, which is an absolutely astounding rate of growth. China, you know, has transformed itself economically and has become an economic, you know, world power. And China then has correspondingly then put money in modernizing its military. And so all the signs really point to the fact that China wants to return to its traditional position as being the superpower in Asia. Now, whether or not the United States, would go along with that, then it's really a very big question.
We have about 10 minutes left in this hour of Focus 580. Our guest, Maria Xiao Zhang, is professor of political science at the University of Nevada in Reno, and is the author of the book about Falun Gong I've mentioned a couple of times here. And if you're interested, certainly this would be a source to go to. It's titled Falun Gong, The End of Days, and it's published by the Yale University Press out just recently. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455, the number to call. We talked a little bit earlier about the crackdown of the Chinese government on Falun Gong. People have been arrested. Some of the Falun Gong followers have died in the custody of the police. And it has gotten some attention from around the world for people who are concerned about human rights. What sort of effect has that had on Falun Gong, the organization?
From all appearances, in terms of what someone like myself or you can find out, and that is through Chinese and the world media, I would say that the government has been successful at cracking down on this particular group. People certainly are no longer, you know, doing the exercises in public parks as they used to do before the government's ban on Falun Gong began, and that was in July 1999, a few months after that massive demonstration in April. And of course, the Chinese Communist Party leadership after the demonstration, instigated a nationwide campaign, a mass campaign to vilify Falun Gong, this group, and then to really instruct and educate the Chinese people that this is a bad group and it has been responsible for all kinds of horrible things, such as people committing suicide, allegedly committing homicide, and that this group is full of lies and deception. And more than that, this Falun Gong is actually treasonous, besides that it aims at nothing less than the overthrow of the state and the disruption of social order and so on and so forth. And so, and as you indicated early in this program, the as part of this nationwide campaign, the authorities have rounded up tens of thousands, reportedly, of Falun Gong followers, put them in so-called labor reform camps, which really are prisons, put them in actual prisons, put them in detention centers. In some milder cases, they would be put under police surveillance, and not just police. The government would have family members keep a close eye on a Falun Gong follower. And reportedly, hundreds have died in very, very suspicious circumstances. And my book provided some accounts of certain individuals that that we know about, you know, by name, what happened to them. You know, some of them would be, after the police had detained them, then a few days later or a couple of months later, the police would release this individual back to the families, and because the person died, and, you know, you would find dried, caked blood on their faces, on their bodies, black and blue bruises all over. I mean, you know, clear signs that they've been tortured. And so international human rights organizations put the number that Falun Gong followers that have died to about 150. Falun Gong itself, the headquarters in New York, claims a death toll of over 350. And so, you know, in many other cases, you know, followers might not have suffered in this grievous manner, but they would have lost their jobs, the family would have been disrupted. And so, really, the government's campaign had been, you know, absolutely ferocious on this particular group, and most of these followers have done nothing other than the fact that they do these exercises. And they, you know, and perhaps believe in Li Hongzhi's ideas, which perhaps to us in the United States might sound really kind of weird and preposterous, but one can argue, you know, the ideas of any religion might seem preposterous and weird to people who don't believe in that religion. And so all the signs point to the fact that Falun Gong is pretty much finished today. But that doesn't mean that whatever underlying social causes for, you know, a group as popular as Falun Gong will not arise today or in the future, and particularly in view of the fact that Falun Gong is only one of many, many other groups, religious and non-religious, that the government has been suppressing in its anti-religion campaign, the campaign that began in 1992. The last chapter of my book gave a list of the groups that have been suppressed, and the followers of whom, members of whom, have been treated, you know, no less charitably by the authorities than the followers of Falun Gong.
We're almost at the point where we're out of time. Maybe we have about a minute. One thing I am curious about, are there reliable numbers for the numbers of Falun Gong followers living outside of China?
No. We don't even have reliable numbers.
For inside of China.
Inside China. Yeah. The numbers range from the Communist Party's figure of 330 million to the Falun Gong's figure of 100 million, about 80 million of which Falun Gong claims live inside China. Now, how many of those today still identify themselves as followers, you know, is anybody's guess.
Well, I want to thank you very much for giving us some of your time and talking with us. It is a fascinating subject, and it's good to have a book that covers it in the kind of depth and detail that yours does, because I don't really think there's anything else out there that does. Professor Zhang, I really appreciate you giving us some of your time today.
And I'm very grateful for this opportunity.
Our guest, Maria Shajiang, is professor of political science at the University of Nevada at Reno. And if you're interested in reading the book that we have mentioned, it is titled Falun Gong, The End of Days, and it's published by the Yale University Press.